my work, even to this day, is centered around the city. I find the city a most fascinating, limitless source of story material. The city is really one of the most exciting places in a civilized planet, because it is there today where the dangers and the excitement are. There was a time when the city was a haven of safety from the jungle. Now that we've conquered the jungle, the city has become the place of danger. So, no, for me, the city is a limitless mine of story material. So everything I do is city-oriented. Also, my art, the way I see things is city-related. I see things in shadows, black and white. I see things in perspective, largely because when you're a city dweller, particularly in this place like New York, you're walking in canyons at all times. Light comes from below, from above or below, never comes from the side. So these these things have an effect on an artist.
Well, in light of that, pardon the pun, how has moving to Florida changed your artwork?
Well, I have a strong memory. I have a very powerful visual recall. But no, I've done a couple of stories about Florida with a Florida setting, Florida scene, and the stories I do today now are a little bit more impressionistic. The artwork is a bit more minimal than it once was, because my interest now, or the thrust of my work now, is to evoke internalization or emotion, and I am no longer involved in the movie-like or the technique aspect.
The Princess and the Frog from NBM, it does have the wider horizons and the more diffuse light.
Exactly. No, I've discovered that there now that I'm down here, that I'm not living in a canyon. That there's lateral scenery. It's horizontal. Things are not vertical anymore. They're all getting more and more horizontal. But seriously, the effect of your environment, of an artist's early environment, has a tremendous influence on how he's able to see things.
Now, should a penciler and inker see things the same way for the best result?
Oh, yes. Well, you're talking to someone who has a deep-seated prejudice against creation of a comic strip by a team of people. Mm-hmm. I think that the most successful comic strip is, or cartoon or graphic novel or whatever you will, is produced by a single individual or by at least only two individuals who are very closely and philosophically attuned to each other, as in the case of Siegel and Shuster.
And yet you're the man who created the shop system to do comic books back in the
30s. Well, yes. Yes, because when you're selling comic pages at $5 a page, it's a little hard to have one man do it all. But no, in those days, you broke it up, not as severely as it's broken up today. We didn't have inkers. We had pencilers and background people. It was a big difference. We had a writer, but the stories were written in early days were highly written in graphic forms. I'd break it down in rough stick figures in the early days of the shop. And later on, we had Tony Blum, who wrote for the first time on a typewriter, which we were all very impressed by. But in the shop, in the early Eisner and Iger shop, you had background people. For example, Jack Kirby would have a background man, or Bob Bowell would have a background man, but he would do the whole basic thing himself. I would have background people. Later on, when I was doing The Spirit After the War, I had Jerry Grandinetti, who was hired because he had come out of an architect's office, and he was a great renderer. He ultimately became his own man. He ultimately became a cartoonist in his own right, but That was the structure that I favored. I found it worked very, very well.
Kind of like Dave Sim does now.
Yeah, well, that's right. Dave Sim uses the same thing, but it's essentially the lifeblood, the rhythm, the soul of a comic strip or a comic or any graphic novel or any graphic storytelling. It rests with a man who composes the panels and executes the individuals involved. I believe that in the structure of a comic, be it a comic book or a comic strip, the penciler is the prime mover.
Now, how did you supervise the lettering? Because one of the things I've always admired about the spirit strips is how the lettering added so much to the emotion of the characters or to the mood of the stories and things like that.
That's a very astute observation on your part. Lettering was done, as I said, the page was laid out in pencil, in a mini pencil form, in rough pencil form, and the lettering was indicated. And I was fortunate for a while to have a very, very brilliant letterer, a fellow named Abe Koenigsen, who was lost track of over the years, who was able to emulate almost any style of lettering and understood lettering the way we understood it in the Eisner shop, but as being a guide for the reader to act out the story, and it also had the task of evoking sound and emotion at the same time. Yeah.
Well, I mean, because you had a lot of different letterers. You know, Sam Rosen and I think DeMuth.
Yeah, and there was a Chinese fellow.
Ben Oda.
Ben Oda. There was.
And in all of them, sort of did a you know, what I think of in my mind as you know, Will Eisner lettering, where whenever there was a strong emotion, the lettering suddenly became very unconventional.
It did, and also it became, we did it smaller, made smaller letters and larger letters. So in one story, the letters, I remember using Gothic letters and so forth and so on. As a matter of fact,
you'd have the words would trail into the stem of the word balloon.
Exactly.
As if, you know, the person is sort of trailing off their thoughts.
Exactly. This is balloons or text is an exercise in frustration because it is very hard to capture something as fragile or as ephemeral as lettering. Not only that, but you are engaged when you're doing a balloon in hiring, if you will, the reader into an acting role. So the reader must really act out or sound out what you ask him to sound out. It's a very, very... I'm a strong believer in the balloons being an integral part of the artwork itself. This is not always so in a lot of the comic book shops in town, because a lot of the artists regard the lettering as their enemy, or it's generally applied kind of after the creative elements of the page are created and the lettering is slapped down, so that and also a lot of lettering is done today on a computer, which of course saps it of any emotional content. So there's a big difference.
Do you remember the Senate hearings on juvenile delinquency in the 50s?
Yes, very, very well, very well. Certainly the Kefauver hearings and the kind of sinking feeling we had in the field when they had Bill Gaines and the other publishers under examination. One thought that this was going to be the end of the comic. It was the first time that I became aware, although I was not directly involved, I became aware of the fact that we were facing the possibility of censorship, and that I would be shortly involved in a medium that was censored. The whole idea was incomprehensible, it was unthinkable, but still there it was. It was coming along. As a matter of fact, I got obliquely involved because I was doing a comic book for newspapers, which raised me out of the comic book market, marketplace, or the comic book ghetto, but I was nonetheless doing a comic book. And
right.
I recall that Mike Wallace had a show at that time called the Mike Wallace Buff Cobb Show. It was a talk show. And they invited me up to debate with a fellow named Senator from Long Island, named Senator Carlino, who had proposed a bill in the state legislature to ban comics.
That is the New York State Legislature.
New York State Legislature, I'm sorry. It was a Dewey was governor of the state at the time, and the thrust of the legislation was to create a law that would enable distributors to ban the distribution of comics. And
that's all comics, whether they're Disney or anything else.
Well, just comics were, that was it. Comics were just a bad thing. It was like, I guess you might say, television was considered, movies were considered at one time. When I was a kid, movies were considered bad for you.
There was even an article in the Lady Home Journal in 1905 that said, Sunday comics are bad for kids, the Sunday pull-out section.
Is that right?
Wow.
Yeah, it's just changing the names.
Well, you weren't alive in 1905.
No, I was not alive. I was probably a thought in my father's head. I didn't know that. But, we have a tendency in this, in all societies, to ban a medium because of what it conveys. We have that problem here a lot in this country, and something that all mediums have to deal with sooner or later. Listen, there was a time when jazz was considered poor music and junk.
Yeah,
now look at jazz has reached
how long before Pokemon? Pokemon gets knocked off the saying it's bad. Well, I've heard that recently. Sometimes even.
we look. We get frustrated. We like to protect our people against bad ideas. You know, there's always a tendency of trying to protect us against ideas that are very bad. And this is there was a time when burlesque was considered the very pit of entertainment, and today you see pornography as being very much worse than the old burlesque shows.